The Larry Mueller Show, and I'm Lee Rayburn, filling in for Larry today. Did you know that today is National Horror Movie Day? I did not. I have been informed this by my producer. So happy National Horror Movie Day, and rather fitting then that we have an opportunity for you to screen world premiere movies, about 36 of them, I believe, 34 in total, that have been filmed here in Wisconsin over the period of, believe it or not, just 2 days. And we'll have their world premiere on Saturday at the Bartell Theater in Madison. And here to tell us about it, Michael Keeney and Kat Thompson. Michael Keeney is a picture car coordinator and stunt car driver for motion pictures, as well as a community producer for the 48-hour film project in Wisconsin. Michael, welcome to you.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Also joining us, Kat Thompson, an actor and the box office manager for the Bartell Theater and a community producer as well for the 48-hour film project in Wisconsin. Kat, welcome.
Thank you.
You can find out more about the 48-hour film project online at the number 8hourfilm.com. That's 48hourfilm.com. And Michael Keeney, get us started and tell us a little bit about the 48-hour film project and how Wisconsin became a part of it.
It is this amazing grassroots, start in your backyard, international, end at the Cannes Film Festival experience. We've come to think of it as a little bit of as a crucible. It will take a cast and crew and in some ways grind them down, but in many ways purify them down to their most basic form. Teams literally have 48 hours to make a short, complete, and completely legal film. Mm-hmm. They don't know until the clocks start ticking what genre their film must be in. They're not allowed to do any creative work beforehand, so they have to go from, well, what about this idea, to a script, to hopefully storyboards, to a production day, to post-production, making sure that they have all the waivers and everything ready to film so it can be screened on any theater in the world.
2 days is what you're given.
Two days.
A genre to go with. And then you're let loose for 48 hours, and then you come back with a finished product?
You also have to have a specific character, a specific line, and a specific prop. So they get all of that information at 7 o'clock. On Friday, and then on Sunday at 7 o'clock, they turn a film in.
Well, we actually give them a half an hour.
Yeah, they do have 7:30.
Oh, 48 and a half hours.
Yes. That's the big secret.
We have to give them a little time because of technology.
Yes.
To get that film uploaded and sent. And there's always a few hiccups when technology is involved.
So tell us about Saturday then. This would be the culmination of the latest 48-hour film project in Wisconsin, and the genre is?
Oh, the genres. There's a number of different genres.
Oh.
So what they do is pull a genre out of the hat.
Yes.
So they didn't really pull out of a hat. Every time we do a contest, we do something a little bit different.
Hats, bonnets.
This time we had old VHS tapes and old DVDs, and when they opened them up, it told them what they had.
So the old cases.
Yes,
and inside the,
old cases
is
of them, yes.
What you'd be doing?
Right.
Wow.
So that's how they knew what the genre is. And there's everything from gothic horror to AI.
Ooh.
What other?
There might be mutation. We do a period horror. So maybe they're trying to do a 30s style horror film or a 50s style horror film.
Classic creatures. And slasher.
Slasher films.
Yeah, slasher films.
And it's not just horror. It's also sci-fi.
Right.
So they might get, a sci-fi romance. Or to be fun, I think one of them is space pirates, ninjas, and cowboys. And, of course, they don't know that until that clock starts ticking. So they cannot. It's against our rules, and it's virtually impossible to pre-write. They have to go, okay, let's throw this on a wall and see what sticks. And sometimes that's an advantage. People think we give them those are obstacles. Really, they're the path.
The path.
They're the path. I got to use this.
Yeah.
And I have to do this. What works?
What story fits these elements?
And it's not unusual. We have competed ourselves in the past.
Sure.
It's not unusual to get all that information and then come up with 4 or 5 different movie ideas.
Oh, no.
And you're like, okay, now, ooh, this one is going to be too complicated to get done in 2 days, but we want to do it, so we'll stick that over here. Oh, this one is really, really good. Do I want to waste it on a 2-day competition?
Oh,
I kind of do. I really want to make this right now. And then you get to pick.
Uh-huh.
It's one of the best things that happened to us competing in the 48 was this just a mass of creativity
yeah.
that happens. Because now you have all these specifics. Okay, how are we going to solve these problems?
So the latest round of films will be screened world premiered on Saturday. Two showings, 1 o'clock and 4:30 at the Bartell Theater in Madison. How many films in total are we expecting?
I think we have 18 in the first block and 19 in the second.
Yeah.
Wow.
I believe that's.
Yep. That's a lot of filmmakers in Wisconsin that I did not even know existed. Who are these people making these films in just 2 days?
It is literally anybody that you can think of, from elementary school teams to Oscar winners. We have people who say, watch a movie and say, how do they do that? They'd want to figure it out.
Yeah.
We have people who have gone to film school or taken a film class, and this is their, hey, buddies, let's get together and have a reunion and also make a movie. We have working professionals. There are people you have paid to see in the big theater that will compete in our competition.
Wow.
And for them, what it is it's an opportunity to get back to what they fell in love with. Like any business, filmmaking becomes a business if it's your career. But when you just have 2 days and you can't spend any money, it becomes, again, about the storytelling and about the filmmaking. So they get to re-fall in love with that thing that brought them to this industry in the first place.
I love that idea. Who decides the victors in these competitions?
That's actually a really good question. Across every city has different judges. In fact, in our city, we have 3 different judges for every competition.
Okay.
What we try to do is we don't want to have the same 3 people and their opinions and their taste kind of determine
everything.
All the winners for every time.
Mm-hmm.
We might have a judge come back, but we try to always have 3 different judges together because they have to agree on who the winners are.
And what are you judging these films on? If elementary school kids can participate right alongside professional movie creators.
They all have the same criteria.
Yeah.
There is an artistic component. The judges look at and say, how good is this as a piece of art?
Mm-hmm.
They have adherence to the assignment. Did they get the line in? Did they get the right genre in? That kind of thing. Technical. So I would say the elementary school kids, they might not win on that technical thing over the guy who's been doing this for a living for the past 40 years.
But they can write a mean story.
But they can write a mean story. We also, here at the Wisconsin 48, we have a student award.
Oh, wonderful.
So that the best of the students of films, they'll have a chance to compete in just that category.
Now, really, they compete in every category.
They compete
category.
In all the categories,
sure.
But they have
this
that
one's
as a,
just for them.
Just
right.
for them.
Right. They can go take the Hollywood producer's candy, but the Hollywood producer can't come back and take theirs.
Yeah.
As it should be.
Yep.
Have you screened any of these films that'll be world premiered on Saturday?
Have we looked at them?
Yeah.
Yeah. We've watched all
yes.
of them.
Is there any preview you can, a glimpse? In, because I understand there are still some tickets available for both showings,
yes.
the one Saturday at 1,
yes.
the one at 4:30, and you can get tickets for both because you'll be seeing different films
right.
yes.
at each
yes.
one.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about that then.
So we have some films that with a lot of blood this time. You're not going to be disappointed. You're not going to be disappointed. If you want to come in and see a splatter fest, you're going to be happy with some of the films that are shown.
But it's certainly not all that.
No.
Certainly at the independent level, a lot of films are dark comedy.
Sure.
And
yeah.
you'll find that as well. There are some films that I found to be genuinely scary.
Ooh.
And a little, some of them are, okay, I'm slightly disturbed. You know, I'm a jaded old man, but...
Seen it all.
Ew. And, you know, there are, I will tell you, there can be some cringy ones. But the reality is if this is their first film...
Yes.
If this is their, look where I started from...
Yes.
This is a pretty great start.
You kind of have to have the cringy ones in
yes.
order to have the classics.
Yes.
I'm speaking as somebody who's had the cringy experience on the radio.
Yep.
In order to get here, you've had to have that. And to put it out there in a community of filmmakers who are supportive and
yes.
have, you know, ideas of their own and want to continue and further, you know, filmmaking for generations to come, I think it's a perfect community to get started in.
And the Bartell is a wonderful venue.
Oh,
It's a historic theater.
Mm-hmm.
We've just recently started doing movies there again.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be the Esquire Movie Theater at one time. So we're back to showing movies there again. And it's an old building. You get 200 of your friends together. Y'all can sit and watch a movie together.
I didn't
so it's
know
a fairly
it was that small.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's a both large and intimate space at the same time.
I love it, and I don't think I remember. I remember seeing plays at the Bartell. I don't remember films at the Bartell.
Yeah, this is we started up last year. Really,
we can get you a ticket if you'd like.
Yeah.
One.
Oh, I think I'll get one of my own. Thank you, Michael. I am very curious about some of these films that'll be world premiered on Saturday at 1 and 4:30 at the Bartell Theater in Madison as part of the 48-hour film project in Wisconsin. How far does this go back for Wisconsin? How long has this been happening here?
I believe they started, there was an administration, there was a couple of people before us. Mm-hmm. There was a Madison competition and a Milwaukee competition.
Oh.
And what we noticed as competitors is when Milwaukee was really strong and had 20 or so competitors, Madison really wasn't. And then the vice versa was true. When we started running Madison, Milwaukee kind of started to fade a little bit. And I think that's just the reality is it's, we're too small of a state. That's why we're now the Wisconsin 48 mm-hmm. instead of the Madison, the Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and the Milwaukee one. And I believe they started about 2010. Kat and I started producing it. We started competing in 2014, mm-hmm. and we started producing it in 2017.
Kat, what got you started in the 48-hour film project? What was it that spoke to you and the thing that keeps you coming back?
So actually, Michael pulled me in. We were
proud over there.
We were working on other projects together, and he said, "Hey, I have an acting part. Do you want to come in and be an actor in this 2-day competition?" I said, "Okay. What do I have to do?" You basically, as an actor, depending on how involved you are in the writing process.
Sure.
But I showed up on Saturday morning, worked all day on Saturday, had a great time, and then I went home, not knowing that he was going to be up all night with the editor, working on editing that and putting that all together and getting all that paperwork and stuff done that I had no clue about. So I had a good time. I thought
let's do it again.
Yeah, let's do that again. The next time, though, I directed and helped produce.
Yeah.
That's a lot more work.
Do you remember what the genre was?
No, gosh.
Fish out of water.
Fish out of water. Oh, that's right. Fish out of water.
Guess who's the writer in the team?
Yes.
I can see. Yeah, Michael.
So, yeah, it was a lot more work, but it was also really encouraging to put that work in and then being able to see it on the screen later. And I have to tell you, there is absolutely nothing like being an actor or producer or anywhere, and you go to, I think we were at a Marcus,
yeah,
and you sit down, and they just played some big superhero movie right before, and now that's your face and your name on the scroll that's coming down. And it was just a superhero movie right before that, and now it's you.
You're the superhero all of a sudden.
I'll tell you, there's something that is close. The first time you see your name on the movie crawl is incredible. But if you're in the business and you've brought your friends in, you've sucked your friends in, you've got that welder who's now your best grip and you won't make a film without him. Thank you very much, Kevin. you know, and now they're in the theater and they get to see their crawl. And at this point in the world, pretty much everybody has heard of IMDb, the Internet Movie Database.
Oh, yes.
Ever look yourself up?
I don't have to, but Michael Sweeney, you will find on IMDb, and evidently the welder grip that you've got.
Absolutely.
Yes. Now on IMDb.
Say that. Yes, you can say that, and I got to say to Catherine, ever look yourself up? You might want to do that, because I'd gotten the film list with IMDb, and to see your friends see not only that crawl, but they have a listing on IMDb is just... It's kind of like being a parent on Christmas morning,
sure,
to be honest.
You're right there with Ryan Gosling and every other... the Internet Movie Database, IMDb.com, and your way to get your own page on that would probably be through the 48-hour film project in Wisconsin, who are world premiering almost 3 dozen films on Saturday at 1 o'clock and 4:30 at the Bartell Theater in Madison. Our guests are the co-community producers for the 48-hour film project in Wisconsin, Michael Keeney and Kat Thompson. And now that you know what's happening here in Wisconsin with the film project, if you have any questions or would like more insight in how you can make films of your own, you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email us anytime, talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. Ever wanted to be on the big screen? Ever wondered what it takes to make a movie of your own? I think all of us have thought about it at one point or another. Well, the 48-hour film project in Wisconsin has a world premiere of almost 3 dozen films coming up on Saturday that is part of their latest project. The films were filmed Backed, I think, October 10th and through the 12th over just 2 days. And here to tell us about the 48-hour film project in Wisconsin's Michael Keeney and Kat Thompson. They're co-community producers. And I haven't asked yet how long these films are. But before I do, if you'd like to enter the conversation, join us at 1-800-642-1234. Kat, how long are these films generally?
They're 4 to 7 minutes.
Is that...
That's one of the requirements of the competition.
4 to 7 minutes, no longer than 7, no shorter than 4. Mm-hmm. And you have to fit an entire story arc in there, which means a setup, which means conflict, which means a resolution and some sort of ending.
I actually think some of our shorter films are the stronger films.
Really?
If you have one idea and you can do it and you have a strong idea, finish it rather than let it drag on. It helps clear out some of the stuff that... Sometimes you watch a film and you get a little bored in the middle. I don't think you'll find that in the short genre.
In 4 minutes.
You're not going to get bored.
There's barely a middle in there.
You have the story and it goes. Now, a lot of our filmmakers do, though, take that film that they've made and make it larger for after our festival.
Yes, I've seen that too, where you take the short film idea and then begin to expand it and see what you can make out of it in a longer format. How many people are doing that with their projects?
Right now, I can think of 4, maybe 5. One of them just wrapped. Feature films being made in Wisconsin that started their lives as 48s.
We don't get a lot of feature films made in Wisconsin.
It's been a while.
The one I remember is Public Enemy, which was filmed around the Madison area, and I remember that. But if you were to ask me, my favorite movie filmed in Wisconsin, it would be American Movie, the documentary about Mark Borchard back, I think, at the turn of the century when he was trying to make a horror movie of his own with his friends and his family. I think it was called The Coven, and it was just this bittersweet documentary about a guy with a vision and you know, wondering where to go with it as he tried to make his horror movie. Boy, could he have used the 48-hour film project.
Absolutely. And the reality is Mark is, I don't want to really say still trading on that production, but that's how Mark Borchardt got to be, quote unquote, Mark Borchardt.
Sure.
And in some ways that Coven was a failure, and I think Mark would say the same, but in the other ways, he learned so much. And just that drive, you know what? I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it.
The love of the game.
Yes.
I was just in awe of that. And that, I mean, that stuck with me for a quarter of a century now. And it's not lost on me that he was making horror movies, the kind of which you're likely to see on Saturday, probably with a little better production, though, on Saturday.
You'd be amazed at some of the production skills that these folks get out in 2 days.
Kat, I watched the most recent winner from the Wisconsin 48-hour film project, The Man in the Box, and I was blown away. I could not believe it was 2 hours, and the story sort of leaves. And you can see it on YouTube, The Man in the Box by Vermilion Pictures. It's available up there for you to watch, and it's less than 7 minutes. But the story it tells in just that time kind of blows your mind. And how they incorporate the genre, the line, and the prop is incredible.
And they had an added difficulty or challenge. The team is actually in two different countries. Part of the team is here in Wisconsin. Part of the team is in Ireland.
What?
And they worked together. They still worked in the same 48-hour period, but they had started together in Wisconsin. One of the gentlemen had to move, and they continue with their process. So one of the actors that you see, those two actors are not in the same room. They're filming separately, and then they put it together.
Now I
got
to go back and rewatch it for that.
You do.
Let's go to Kevin in Madison, who has a question. Kevin, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you guys for having this topic and sharing all the great stories of behind this magnificent project you guys have. My question is if there's any involvement with any of the University of Wisconsin Communication Arts or any other kind of partners with getting more hands in this.
We're absolutely always trying. In the quote unquote off season, I have told anybody that will listen, and more than that will listen, actually, I will come to your school. I will come to your Lions Club meeting. I will come to your bar mitzvah and talk about film and film in Wisconsin. We work as closely as we can with the university system. We have had a number of university system students. We'd always like to be closer. So if there are profs out there that would like to have us come and talk about it, you know how to reach us.
Yeah, I think we're in a building here on the UW campus that are filled with future filmmakers, possibly. If they could find the avenues to, and I think that's kind of the what's the avenue to get into a career in filmmaking? And it feels like the 48-Hour Film Project is a wonderful place to start to connect and see what you can create.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I love about the 48. I remember when I was a student, and still, I will go to a movie theater and you'll walk out and you'll hear people around you saying, you know what I would have done if I'd have done it? And you can think in your back of your head, you know what I did? What I did do it? And that's a feeling like no other. But the opportunity exists. Some of our rules are, they may feel restrictive, like you're not allowed to pay anyone.
Right.
But that levels the playing field.
Right.
That means that you and I are both competing with our creativity, not our checkbook.
Nice.
And that really distills the filmmaking.
One of the aspects that you'd touched on, Michael, is the legal clearance that's required for a film. And that is part of the 48-Hour Film Project, is the 48-Hour Film Project website has the documents that you need for waivers for everybody that's going to be on the screen, for music that has copyright clearance. So this is an actual film that has legal clearance and can be taken elsewhere. So when the winners are selected, where do they go from Wisconsin?
There will be a Wisconsin champion. And that one will go to what we call Filmapalooza, which is sort of our international round of competition.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be probably 150 films, because some communities do multiple film competitions like Wisconsin does, that are competing for a shot to be screened at Cannes, at the Cannes Short Film Corner.
And we film about 25 films at the Short Film Corner.
Whoa.
And we have had multiple Wisconsin films make it to Cannes.
I don't think I've ever heard that before, that Wisconsin films have been featured at the Cannes Film Festival.
Yep.
At the Short Film Corner. So the Short Film Corner is in relation to the Cannes Film Festival. It's not the Cannes Film Festival itself.
Right.
It's in conjunction with it. And oftentimes films are shown there just on a screen for producers to maybe purchase.
Oh.
However, the 48 has two screenings where audiences come in and do live screenings there.
Yeah.
So our filmmakers have flown over to France and have been part of that.
And it's very much a marketplace as well.
Oh, yeah.
And we also have one of those features that I talked about that just wrapped is a direct result of the filmmaker making a connection while he was in Cannes. That they were talked to the filmmaker, liked what they saw, liked that guy's plan, and gave him a budget to do a feature. And they've just wrapped.
Isn't that the dream? Like, isn't to take the idea all the way to a career and, you know, a place on IMDb, isn't that the dream?
That's exactly.
Well, and for us, certainly, Kat and I have different backgrounds. I'm the Wisconsin cliche, dairy farmer raised and all that. Kat grew up in the big city in Detroit. But for me, the dream has always been, as we've progressed in our careers, you see the young talent, you see them grow up, and you see them look to the coasts, because you can't make movies here. That's the narrative. Well, it's not true. And for us, the dream is always to make more people, to make more your young people aware that it's no longer true. The tech is here. The talent is here. We can do this right here.
Kat, what are you expecting from Saturday? What's it going to be like at the end of Saturday's screenings? When it's all said and done and everybody's seen what they put on the screen, what's the aftermath like?
Well, I think there's always a lot of excitement. A lot of those people, that's the first time they've seen their work on screen. So that's such a buoy of just so much excitement, so much emotion. A lot of them are probably going to go to city restaurants. They're going to go downtown and they're going to hit those restaurants and bars that we have down there to keep the event going. Because our second one starts at 4:30.
Yeah.
It's not going to go more than, say, 2.5 hours.
Right.
So they're going to have plenty of time to go experience all that together.
Well, I want to sit and talk about it. I want to rehash everything we just saw and sort of process it and figure out, will the winners be announced on Saturday?
So we actually have another ceremony on November 22nd.
Oh!
So November 22nd, again at the Bartell Theater.
Uh-huh.
It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we will do a reprise screening of maybe our top 10, 12 films.
Yes.
And then announce all the awards then.
How many events do you have per year, Michael?
Currently 2.
Okay.
There may be, this is where I get kicked under the table, there may be a third one coming. They have asked us to do a third.
There were no kicks.
No, there wasn't. So We have two competitions. Each competition, though, has the screening.
Yep.
And then an award show.
Yep. Okay.
And then we also have meetings throughout the year where we all get together. Whoever wants to gets together just to talk film, talk what's going on, meet each other.
Oh, that's cool.
We probably meet every twice a month.
We call it Odd Date Tuesdays, and that's exactly what it is. Is on the Odd Date Tuesdays, we get together at a local watering hole, and it's very much we talk about film. We also we talk about Hollywood. We talk about Bollywood. We talk about the news of the day. We talk about ripped from the headline storylines. And what's great about that is those filmmakers that come start to look at the other filmmakers not as competition, but as peers. And when they're talking about the productions that they want to make outside of our competition, well, they get to talk to those other filmmakers. And through our competition, they get to see who's good. They know, I really want to work with that actor, or I love how that DP put together that shot. And then these productions that they make outside of our competitions get to be sort of an all-star team.
Yes.
And that's what happens on Saturday, too.
Yes.
Is the filmmakers are there, and they get a chance to say, oh, I just saw this wonderful film. I really like how that was edited and put together. Tell me who your editor is. And then they don't think about, oh, they're going to be poaching. It's more, I'm doing more projects than just the 48. I'm doing other projects. So it's a way to network.
Doesn't this mirror and parallel some of the successful Hollywood stories we've seen in the past, how directors work together and how, like, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg were in, you know, cahoots more than they were in competition?
Absolutely.
And these great actors were, you know, trying to better each other and compete against each other, but at the same time, we're doing it together.
One of the things, we're a competition.
Yeah.
Our community has a co-opetition. It absolutely happens. There'll be a WhatsApp thread or a Facebook thread, and somebody will say, oh my goodness, I just realized I need this lens. Does anybody have this lens?
Yes.
During the competition. And they'll swap gear back and forth. We had one film that was actually became an award winner in that year, where it was a bunch of comedian writers and stage actors, and they had written a script and were ready to shoot it, and realized none of them had a camera.
It's like forgetting your undies on a vacation.
Because that's not what any of them did. They got not only a camera, but one of the assistant DPs was willing to go and become the DP for that production.
Wow.
And it becomes, I hate to say family, that's a little too much, but it definitely has become a community. And that's probably one of the things that we're most proud of.
I love that, Michael. And I'm grateful to hear it. And that sounds unique. It sounds Wisconsin. It sounds like exactly what we would do. There have to be costs incurred in this, though, right? There are some just technical and aspects. So how do you cover what basic costs you might have for this process?
So for the filmmakers themselves, there's a registration fee.
Okay.
And then obviously they have to buy tickets to the screenings. We do give out two tickets to each team, but there's obviously more than two people on most teams.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to buy tickets. A lot of the team members pool their money together,
okay,
and make a film. Or sometimes the team leader just pays for it, that kind of thing. For us, of course, we have to get the venue. We have trophies.
Right.
There's all sorts of our costs. We make all of that only on ticket sales.
So tickets for Saturday.
Tickets for 1 Saturday.
1 o'clock and 4:30 at the Bartell Theater are still available at the Bartell Theater website. And again, it's 1 and 4:30, and you can get tickets to both because you'll be seeing different 48-hour film projects at each. Let's go to Jonah in Hortonville next. Jonah, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for calling.
So, I went to school for animation, and we had not a 48-hour animation festival, but a 24-hour animation festival.
No.
If you know anything about animation, it takes a long time, and you have to be crazy to do it. So to do it on no sleep, you really have to be like a Stanley Kubrick bags under the eyes type guy.
Well, and I'll tell you, we have one of our filmmakers that does animation. They do animation every year. That's just their shtick, and I don't mean to say shtick, but
that's their medium.
And their artist often does watercolor,
what?
Or it morphs from one scene to another.
Oh.
And we talked earlier about being an international award winner.
Yeah.
That one won the 48 animation globally.
Wow. From Wisconsin.
From Wisconsin.
Jonah, what was your 24-hour animation like?
Well, you'll be disappointed to find out I was too chicken.
Ah!
Jonah, you got to do it, man.
Well, how about we double that 24, we make it 48, and we get you into the film project here?
That I think I could do, because honestly, the last part to this is just a tip for anybody who's going to be pulling one or two all-nighters. Get like 9 to 10 hours of sleep, if you can, the couple nights before. Stock up on sleep so that you don't, you know, keel over during the festival.
That's some wise logistics from Jonah Northville on making a film in a day or two. Stock up on your sleep because you aren't getting one once the competition begins.
And make sure you hydrate while you're up all night.
I think that's great. So you've got the event coming up Saturday. You've got the award winners announced November 22nd at the Bartell. You've got your odd date Tuesdays for getting together and gathering. And you can find out more about the 48-Hour Film Fest in Wisconsin at the number 48hourfilm.com/Wisconsin for more details there. What comes after November 22nd?
We immediately start working on next year.
We do. We start getting ready for spring.
We've already started working on next year. The first thing for us, we have to have a theater. This time around, we've been fortunate that there was a small window with the Bartell that we were able to get in. But if we can't screen them, we can't honestly go to the community and say, hey, you get screened on a big screen if we can find one. And unfortunately, as theaters have become more and more international conglomerates, scheduling theaters has become harder. So we are already working on 2026.
Your own logistics there.
Yep.
And I could see where that might be part of the big hurdle to get it, the 48-hour film project underway and invite everybody out. Let's go to John and Madison next. John, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Not sure if this is quite on topic. I'm no longer practicing DGA assistant director. I miss it a lot. Just wondering if there's opportunities for like volunteering in that capacity or.
No, that's a perfect question, John, and I'm glad you asked.
Most definitely. That'll happen a lot. People will come to our those Two Shot Tuesdays and just say, hey, this is what I do. Does anybody need this? And you become part of the community and you'll get to see some of the films. You get to see all the films if you come on Saturday, and you'll be able to talk to the filmmakers. There's definitely a process where everybody who makes these films are volunteers. If you want to be part of the community, there's a home for you here.
Well, and you know what I hear from John is the same thing I hear in radio all the time is, you know, I left it, but I would give anything to find a way back in. Just it sort of gets in your blood, right?
It does. It's in your system.
Part of who you are. It's the way you sort of start to see the world. And it, to be a part of that always feels like you're part of something greater than yourself.
And, John, it's only 48 hours. You could give us a weekend.
Kat, what's your hopes for the 48-hour film project in Wisconsin? What would you like to see as, you know, the fruits of all the labor that you've put into this?
Well, I'm hoping that it continues and grows, that we touch. I would like to see more students involved.
Yeah.
I think that it's important for us to not only give a space for those of us who are adults, who are in the business in some other capacity to show our creativity, but I think it's important to get those students involved and show them, hey, here's a way that you can express yourself, express your ideas and thoughts. So I would like to see more students involved. Michael and I actually have started a scholarship for student teams. We do one scholarship out for each competition. The way that you contact us is just email us, and then we will give you the process and how we go about that. Those teams would have to be led by a student and be over 50% comprised of students.
Led by a student and over 50% students.
That's to qualify for the scholarship.
Okay.
And as Catherine mentioned earlier, that there is a fee to register. In this case, that's not Catherine and I waiving that fee. That's Catherine and I writing that check.
Fee.
Okay, so you're paying the fee yourself.
Right, so that goes to the Global 48.
And that's how important we think it is to get our students, our young people involved in this competition.
When it goes back to those who already have it in their bloodstream and those to find out whether or not it gets in their bloodstream and they can't leave it no matter what and have the stories that they want to tell seen on the big screen. Who are some of the big names that we know that have participated in the 48-Hour Film Project internationally?
Well, locally, at one point in time, virtually every local news station has fielded a team.
That's probably
true. Oh, that's
true.
Neat.
Sometimes I'd be curious more than one at a time.
Interesting.
We've had, not in our competition, but we have had Martin Freeman participate.
The British actor.
The British actor. Gareth Edwards, who is well known for Rogue One in Star Wars, started in London, started his first film, and that's what he says, his first film was a student film that he did as a 48.
And it was only like 8 years after that film that he did Rogue One.
So that's kind of what I would like to see, is that somebody who puts their first film on the screen at the Bartel this weekend is putting their first full-length feature on screens internationally in the years to come.
It happens every year. Every year someone gets their golden ticket. Every year they...
Maybe not from Wisconsin, but somebody in the 48 years.
Yeah, someone's career will start on Saturday. I mean, it really started October 10th or 12th.
Right.
But someone will discover, they'll fall in love with the art form, and it'll resonate, and they will make it. This will be their lifeblood.
How exciting is that? The 48-Hour Film Project in Wisconsin is featuring their latest round of films on Saturday at the Bartel Theater in Madison at 1 o'clock and again at 4:30 with different showings at each, so you can get tickets for both. And then stay tuned for November 22nd when the winners will be announced. Again, that'll be at the Bartel Theater at 2 p.m., and you can find more online at the number 48hourfilm.com. Michael Keeney, Kat Thompson, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah, and we'll do it again. So stay in touch and let's go to the movies.
All right. Great, love that.
Coming up next, we go to Australia, about as far away as you can get from Wisconsin winter. What do you say? We take a tour with our tour guide, Glenn Schmidt, next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and this is WPR News. Ooh, a little didgeridoo. What do you say? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show. And I suppose if you were going to say, why are we doing the didgeridoo today? You'd have to say, Australia. Well, you know, if you were looking to get away this winter and find the middle of summer, I imagine you would want to visit Australia. And here to tell us about it with a travel guide, Glenn Schmidt. He is the author of Travel Lessons, Your Personal Guide to Better Travel, which is available now on Amazon.com. And get ready for his new book coming out this spring, Travel Lessons for Seniors, published by Henschel House Books out of Milwaukee. And Glenn, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Good to be here.
When'd you go to Australia?
You know, I came back on Saturday night, and you would hope that jet lag would kind of release you.
Yeah.
But yesterday, my wife came home about 2:30 in the afternoon, and she said, why are you in bed? I said, because I see no reason to get out.
But you just got back then.
I did. So it is awfully fresh in my mind.
How long were you there?
I was there a couple of weeks.
And would you, if I were to visit Australia, would you say 2 weeks is a bit too long or just right?
Well, you take what you can get. And,
okay.
You know, that's what I could get on this trip. But, you know, ideally you'd want to, it's a country as big as the U.S. in area. But the fact is that there's almost nothing in the interior.
Right.
And everybody lives on the coast, particularly I spent most of my time in Melbourne and Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really interesting cities in themselves. They're each about 5.5 million people.
Whoa.
You know, I always thought, well, Sydney's a big city, but they're both about the same now. But they have a very different feel to them.
Now, how would you compare them?
There's a cliche out there in Australia that if you like Los Angeles, you will love Sydney. And if you like New York City, you'll love Melbourne.
Well, I don't know a lot of people that love L.A.
Well, there is that.
The thing I think of first and foremost, Glenn Schmidt, when I think of traveling to Australia, is the travel itself.
Yes.
That would take, I believe, how long did it take for you to get there?
Well, it took me 34 hours.
That's a travel.
That is. Now, you can do it in a little bit less time. So there were actually seven of us on this trip.
Oh.
And we didn't all take the same flights. I wanted to be on Cathay Pacific. Now, have you ever heard of that airline?
I have not.
Well, it always ends up in the top five in any list of good airlines. And I had read about it, and I had seen YouTube videos on it, and I thought, I need to try that. But a friend of mine took a United flight directly from Chicago to Sydney. And if you do that, you don't have to do 34 hours. You can get by with under 30.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter. I
mean, but you'd plan for more than a day of travel.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which would screw up your body clock, I would imagine. So how do you adjust once you get there, Glenn?
I've always found in all the travels I've done is you get on schedule as soon as you can. As soon as you, you land, you reset your watch or you let your phone get reset, and that is your body time now. And so you kind of force it.
Is travel cost prohibitive?
Here's the thing about travel down there. If you just travel in economy, would it surprise you to know that paying more money makes it more comfortable? Here's the deal. My friend Mary Jo, who took the United flights out of Chicago, paid about $1,600 round trip on United. Now, I paid about double that, about $3,400, just so I could try that premium economy. Now, what do you get for premium economy? Well, instead of they call it pitch between the seats. So instead of 32 inches, which is typical in economy, you get 40 inches between you and the seat in front of you. And as far as
leg room,
and as far as width, the seats in premium are they're 2, 4, and 2. In economy, they're 3, 4, and 3. So you can tell that you're going to have really a lot more room. But, you know, you're still in a metal tube.
Right, for a long, long time.
For a long time, yes.
Yeah, but once you arrive, what's it like landing in Australia and you get out and the air, what's it smell like? What's it look like? I mean, it's a different world. It's a different continent.
That's pretty visceral. And I don't know how to answer that because by the time you get there, your senses are so numb that it's awfully hard to, it's about all you can do to get out the door and hail a taxi and get to your hotel. But let me take a little side trip here, Lee, if you don't mind. If you've ever followed Uber at all, and how they operate around the globe, I find them fascinating. I tend to take taxis rather than Uber, but occasionally I'll take an Uber. But in Sydney, the taxis have given up the premium spot right in front of the airport, and now that's Uber.
Okay.
So there must have been some kind of deal that they've come to, because in many places, like you go into Rome, Rome has done their best to absolutely eliminate Uber.
Interesting.
And so you've got very different things happening if that's how you plan on getting around. You better check to make sure if it's going to work for you.
So you went to Australia just last week.
Yeah.
What's it like down there this time
of
year?
Well, it's spring. But the first thing I discovered is that spring allergies down there are just as much fun as they are in Wisconsin.
I would never have thought of that. Spring allergies.
Exactly. And my brother and I were walking down a Melbourne street, and I don't know, something blew our way, but we're both having a sneezing attack walking down the street. And I think, okay, you can't get away from that.
No, you can't. So would you be able to, what's the best time of year to go to Australia?
I would say this is the time to go. If you get into summer, the locals said, it's awfully hot and steamy here.
Even on the coast.
Even on the coast, Sydney especially, and the reason they compare it to L.A. is if you get just a little bit out of Sydney. It's kind of a beach culture.
Oh,
so okay. From downtown Sydney, right by the Opera House, you hop onto a ferry and you go to Manly Beach. And Manly Beach is, when we were there, I don't know if you could have found a place to put a blanket down. There were so many people.
Really?
Yeah. It was.
And this is kind of off season.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. But, you know, Sydney itself, though, I found to be, I would compare it more to Chicago. I saw more people wearing suits in Sydney and more women wearing impractical shoes than at any time since I used to go to Washington, D.C. regularly. Yeah. So I found it very formal in that way.
Was it easy to understand the Australian accent?
Not a bit. And I've actually tried to emulate it, and my son said to me, "Dad, don't do that."
You want to give it a shot here?
Not a chance. No. I've been warned. He's listening.
What was your relationship like with the people that you did get to meet?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. We have friends in Sydney, and part of the reason for going there was to see them. I've been active in the international teachers unions.
Sure.
And when I was in Brazil about, I don't know, 15, 16 years ago, I met Maury from Australia, who became the president of the New South Wales Teachers Union. And so anyway, we went down, we've traveled with Maury and Helen, and so we went down to visit him. And every time that Maury came and did something, that was the best part of the trip. Because when you see it through the eyes of a local, you know, that you can't duplicate that.
Then you're not a tourist anymore. You're a guest.
You're a guest.
Yeah. Exactly. And there's a difference there, right?
Yeah. Well, and Maury has an extra gear, too. He wasn't just a teachers union leader. He's a folk singer. Who has, I don't know, four or five albums out. And when we stopped at his house, this is about we took the train about an hour south of Sydney, and he picked us up. And after we had dessert at their house, he kind of gave us an impromptu concert.
Oh.
And so...
Man, Glenn.
Yeah, so that was very cool.
The food in Australia?
Well, you know, obviously you're going to have a lot of seafood. I mean, everybody's on the coast. And so there's a fish called barramundi.
Barramundi.
Yes. You ever heard of that?
I have heard of it, but I've never tasted it.
It seemed to be on every menu that we encountered. So it was ubiquitous down there. And it was very good. But it came in all sorts of different configurations.
Barramundi and...
But the main thing is that you can't overestimate the Asian influence in Australia. About a third of Australians were not born in Australia.
Sure.
And most of them are really coming from Asian countries around there. So there are all sorts of restaurants from places around the world and countries that you've never even been to.
Yum cha.
Yum cha, that's right.
What is it?
I had never heard of that. But so our friend Maury took us to Chinatown in Sydney, and we had yum cha. And that consists of, it loosely translates to brunch, in, you know,
okay,
from our point of view. But you sit at a large communal table, and about every two or three minutes, a trolley comes over. And they have, you know, some delightful thing that, and they ask, you know, how many of these pork buns do you want, or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the buffet comes to you.
The buffet comes to you. I like that. That's good.
I'm yum cha. That's on my list.
Yeah.
And if you were going to Australia, what would you want to see? What questions do you have about going down under? You can join our conversation with our tour guide, Glenn Schmidt, by giving a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email the show anytime, talk@wpr.org. Glenn's the author of Travel Lessons, Your Personal Guide to Better Travel, available now on Amazon.com. And coming out this spring, look for it, Glenn Schmidt's latest book, Travel Lessons for Seniors, published by Henschel House Books out of Milwaukee. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and we'll continue touring Australia after a look at the news. This is WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry Mueller today. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show and the Didgeridoo, which takes us down under with our travel guide, Glenn Schmidt, joining us. He's the author of Travel Lessons, your personal guide to better travel, and the upcoming book, look for it this spring, Travel Lessons for Seniors. On Saturday, Glenn returned from his two-week voyage to the Down Under, and he's here to report back on what to see if you go, when you go, and what perhaps you can skip. And Glenn, you said you were in Sydney and Melbourne and some of the outlying areas, but when I think of Sydney, I think of the Sydney Opera House, and I'm wondering what you would recommend when it came to visiting, touring this world wonder.
It is a stunning building. There's no question about that. But if you go down there, I would highly recommend going to an event there. They're very accessible, and they kept stressing to us that this is an event center. We're not just putting operas on. We're not just putting symphonies out there. And when we were there, the musical Rent was on.
Oh.
And also in the other theater, there was something to do with Donna Summer and her music and disco. And so it's not really what you expect from an opera house. But as far as the tour was concerned, there were the building itself is, you can imagine, it's just balkanized. I mean, it looks spectacular from the water or from the harbor bridge. We actually walked across the harbor bridge, and it's a spectacular view. But, you know, walking around the opera house itself is really chopped up, and there are just tons of stairways that I got kind of tired of real fast.
So see an event there and maybe skip the tour.
That's what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you have questions about traveling the Outback or the Down Under, you can join our conversation with Glenn at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org.
Can I talk about the Blue Mountains for a second?
Yeah, what are the Blue Mountains?
Well, we got out of Sydney by taking a day tour to the Blue Mountains, and I would call it their Grand Canyon. I mean, it is absolutely spectacular. And they took us out there, but the Aussies have a wonderful sense of humor, and it's unlike any. Can I give you an example?
Yes,
of it?
Please.
All right, here's an example. Our guide said to us, "Okay, I'm taking you up here to this site," and he said, "but I won't be going on the aerial tram ride with you. It has an appalling safety record."
You guys have fun.
That's right. You guys have fun. And another one was one of the drivers said, "Your driver will be a little bit late. He's just leaving the pub now."
Okay. All right.
So that's Australian humor.
See how you react and what sort of sense of humor you have, Glenn.
Exactly.
That's perfect.
But taking the tram down the mountain was spectacular. And then there's kind of a cog railway where you come back up. Mm. And it is probably scarier than the tram ride was.
Wow. So. What about the wildlife in Australia?
Well, we went to two different places. The Sydney Zoo, which I absolutely would not recommend.
Oof.
And a place about an hour south of there that I thought was much better. There is a zoo in Sydney that is a much better one. We just ended up at the wrong one, I'm afraid. And we picked a bad day, too. There was about 40-mile-an-hour winds going on.
Okay.
And so they had taken many or most of the animals inside for obvious reasons. You can see plenty of wildlife there. But, you know, what are you mainly looking for? You know, I'm looking for a kangaroo. And the red kangaroo is just not native to that part of Australia. So when we asked about it, they said, well, there's two reasons. You know, it's not native to this, and they're really mean. they've got a kick to them.
I noticed that kangaroo meat was on the menu in some places.
I didn't try it. It didn't seem right to me. But one of the people with us tried it, and she found it fairly tasty. But the other animal that everybody wants to
koala.
See is a koala.
Yes, please.
And so at one of the places we were at, we were treated to like 10 or 15 minutes of a guide holding the koala in her arms while she talked about eucalyptus leaves and the different things that you have to do to keep a koala going. So that part was pretty cool.
What are some of the hot spots that you would make a point of making sure to see in Sydney? I mean, the Opera House, go to a show, skip the tour, the zoo, skip it all together. What are some of the hot spots?
I think the first thing that I would say is, you know, learn to get around the town using the trams.
Mass transportation.
Mass transit. There is always a tram going by on the rails. Our hotel, the tram was right outside the door, and they had a very slick way of using them. All you had to do is take your credit card, tap a spot on a post mm-hmm. right by the tram, and then when you got off on the other end, do a tap. And we checked on, so one time when we went to Chinatown, you know, we just, one of our people was checking to see what it cost, and it was 66 cents for that ride. So, and what's magic about 66 cents? Well, that is how much an Australian dollar is worth compared to a U.S. dollar.
Oh.
So when you see a menu and it says something is $40, well, okay, divide that by, take a third off of that to see what the actual price is.
Hmm.
Yeah, now the other thing is definitely use the ferries that are, many of them.
You took one to the beach.
We took one to the beach, and the funny thing about that, so it's to Manly. Uh-huh. And so we went to Manly. We didn't know what we were going to do there. We just hopped on the ferry, and then we got off, and then we just followed the crowd. And we get to a beach, and there are all these people on the beach. But the place I was aiming for was called Hemingway's. Now, I've been collecting Hemingway places from all over the world. So in my next book, I've got the top five Hemingway bars that I've been to. Because, you know, what's Hemingway known for, after all?
Writing, Glenn.
Well, writing. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. And I've read probably 15 or 20 Hemingway biographies, and I know that Hemingway never went to Australia. I mean, he went to Africa, he went to Asia, he never went to Australia. But this was Hemingway's, and they had all sorts of memorabilia inside for him, and it was still a good experience, even though it was kind of inauthentic.
Well, he'd never been there. It didn't mean that there wasn't some part of maybe the cats or something from Key West.
Oh, the cats from, yeah.
You also traveled to Melbourne, and when it came to the sights in Melbourne, what would you make sure to see, and what could you leave off the list?
Well, the big thing in Melbourne is to go to the Sky Deck. The Sky Deck is the highest vantage point in the Southern Hemisphere. So you go up into this skyscraper and you go into a room, and it's kind of a cantilevered sort of a thing where it goes out away from the building, and then the floor becomes transparent. So it might bother some people to go out on that. But before you even get up to the 88th floor of this building, they put you through a virtual experience. They put you in an egg-shaped chair, and then they give you some VR glasses, and you get a tour of Melbourne. And it's a very realistic tour, because the first thing, you're in a helicopter, and this chair, you know, makes it feel like...
Oh, where it drops out on you and you feel the...
Exactly. And then you're on a roller coaster, and you're, honest to God, you're putting your hands down looking for a seatbelt, because, you know, the chair is kind of pushing you forward when the, roller coaster
is even
going.
Before you get to the Sky Deck.
That exactly, yeah. So they've kind of prepped you, and... If you're a little bit tending to motion sickness, you might want to skip that part. I was a little queasy when I got to the top.
Other points of Melbourne to hit up?
Melbourne, I would say the biggest thing there is we talked a little bit about the food, but the Asian food places in particular. We were there the last night, and it was just my brother and me, and I said, let's just bail out. There's a Kentucky Fried Chicken across the street. And he said, I'm not doing that. I said, okay, I agree with you. And
I can feel the inertia, American pull towards let's just go get some fried chicken at KFC. I get it, Glenn.
So we went instead across the street to a place that said, "I love chicken." That was the name of the place. It was a Japanese chicken restaurant, and it was way better than we would have gotten at the other place. But there was one problem with it, and they gave you your utensils.
Uh-huh.
Guess what? It's not a spork. It's chopsticks. And so
shouldn't you be well-versed in chopsticks at this point?
Well, yes,
Glenn
I should, but I would be, if I lived there, I'd be a lot thinner because it's...
it's a lot of work.
Yes, it takes a little longer to do it that way.
But kudos to you and your brother for not asking for a spork.
Oh,
I know. Would they know what a spork is in Australia?
I don't know.
Did you have, was that the best meal you had, would you say? Or?
The best meal was probably at the seafood restaurant right on the harbor. And in my guidebooks, I use Arthur Frommer's Australia, and I think that's a terrific guidebook series. But this area didn't get a lot of love. But when I went there, this harbor area had three different levels of restaurants just circling the bottom of the harbor, and it was all lit up, and it was just spectacular at night. And it's like you could probably pick any random restaurant there, and you'd have great food, especially seafood.
Right.
So that was the best meal that we had there, I would say.
Glenn Schmidt joining us, just returned from Australia in a couple weeks in Sydney and Melbourne and the outlying areas. And if you'd like to join the conversation with questions for Glenn or your own Australian experiences, you can give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Rachel in Mosinee. Rachel, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
You asked what was our favorite thing that we saw or did when we were in Australia.
Absolutely.
Actually, I loved it all. We saw so many things. But the most memorable was the little penguins. We waited on a beach to see them, and we got talking to an Aussie who was sitting there, and we became friends. And we have stayed friends over the years. They are wonderful people. They are so darn helpful and so friendly.
How long ago was this, Rachel?
It's probably been 10 years now.
And where were the penguins?
I'm just getting out my atlas here. We were on the beach across the water from Tasmania.
Oh, wow. Oh. I did not think of... Rachel, thank you so much for the call, because I did not think of penguins in Australia. Of a million things that I would expect to find in Australia, Glenn, penguins not on the list.
Penguins definitely are on the list down there. We did not get to Tasmania, but Tasmania has its own charms that... if I do another trip over there, I'll be certain to go there.
How far away is that from the Sydney-Melbourne?
It would be just a quick flight from Melbourne.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, it's just over the water. But here's one of the other things that I think people should go to. I love going to markets wherever I am.
Local markets.
Local markets.
Yes.
And the one in Melbourne is called the Queen Victoria Market. And it is one of the best markets in Australia. But here's where preparation comes in. It turns out they have the market every day but Monday. But on Wednesday, it turns out it's a night market, and it opens at 5. So guess which day we went to the market? Well, it was Wednesday, and it didn't work very well. But the one we went to in Sydney is called The Rocks. And this is an area not far from the Opera House, and it's kind of the old part of Sydney. And for a while, they were trying to gentrify it, but it is still really unique and very old. And so drifting among the different stalls there. My brother actually bought a hat that made him look like Crocodile Dundee. Yeah. So,
well, win in Australia, Glenn.
Well, exactly.
Rachel, thank you again for the call. You enlightened me about all the things that you can find in Australia. Glenn, you've got a new book coming out here, coming up this spring, Travel Lessons for Seniors, and I'm curious a little. I really want to know, for the sake of my parents and other, you know, folks who still want to travel but understand that they may be limited in ways that, you know, they didn't used to be, how to accommodate for themselves and still find ways to get around the world.
I just had this discussion with my publisher a couple of weeks ago, and we sat down, and she said, and I said, what do you think of this? The first book is called Travel Lessons, but I'd like the next one to be Travel Lessons for Seniors. And she said, you know that publishers love to have your target audience in your title. And she said that's who you're selling your book to anyway, because Amazon will break things down for you, you know, as far as the categories of travel that you're doing well in. What you'll see in the next book, and it's about 80% done, is you'll see sections of it that are just aimed specifically at senior travelers and what makes them a little bit different. For example, while taking local transportation is sometimes a great idea, often a place like Paris, where there are so many steps going down into the metro and coming back out, and often a very long walk between metro stations, so that'd be very difficult as opposed to taking a cab ride across town. So you make those accommodations. But the other thing is that you'll see kind of stuck in most of the articles and pieces that are in it, you'll see a different point of view that takes into account the fact that that, you know, maybe you've just retired and you just want to travel, but you don't necessarily want to go on the tour,
right?
Because my attitude about tours is, if you got to go on a tour, go ahead and do that. I really try to avoid them as much as I can and do my own traveling and do my own booking and stuff like that. And I think you see a much better piece of the places you go if you have that kind of knowledge where you're comfortable enough to do that.
So yeah, with Travel Lessons for Seniors, is this going to take us around the world again, Glenn? Is this...
It is actually going to take you around the world even more than the first book did, because I felt I didn't do justice to Asia, and I didn't mention Australia at all in the first book. I didn't do enough of South America. I was really very Europe-centered, and there'll still be plenty of, I mean, I love Paris, so I'll go back there in a heartbeat. But there'll be a lot of the rest of the world, too. And that includes cruising. Now, if you want something that's really aimed at your parents and at seniors,
yes,
cruising is something that is much more doable. If you're having a bad day and your lumbago's acting up, don't get off the boat. You know, don't worry. They're still going to feed you. They're still going to entertain you. And it's a good way to do it. But you have to pick the right cruise line, the right cruise ship. If you don't do that, you know, if you're an older person, you pick Carnival. You know, if you don't mind being around drunk 30-year-olds throwing up, and I shouldn't say that, but it's a different clientele than perhaps if you're on a Cunard ship dressing up every night.
You're looking for an experience with people who are having the same experience around you, not folks who are on a different demographic altogether in a different schedule.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You have any trips on the horizon? Now, I understand you just got back from Australia on Saturday.
I did, but I'm always planning two or three trips ahead. So I will be getting on a ship in Hong Kong in early February. And the ship will be taking us from Hong Kong up to Taiwan and then Japan, and we will finish in Korea.
Oh, wow. How long will that trip take?
That's about 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of group are you bringing with you?
Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting question. We've actually got about 10 cabins. I have been working with a travel agent out at Easttown at AAA. And so I've got friends who when they heard about this, they said, well, we want in on that. So,
yeah.
So we've got about 10 cabins that are, it'll be a nice group that we're traveling with. But it's a small ship, too. It's an Oceania ship, which holds fewer than 1,000 people. And most of the cruise ships that you get on Holland America and Norwegian and stuff, they're around 3,000 people. So the cool thing about these smaller ships is they can usually dock in a better place.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And last year we were on one that docked in Monte Carlo. Last time I was in that area with a bigger ship, we had a dock out of the harbor and tender in.
Mm-hmm.
And this time we were docking in the harbor. Much better experience because you just get off the boat and you're in the middle of town.
You're much more worldly than me. I have not been around like you have.
But yeah, you're invited to join us on the next trip.
I'm thinking about it, Glenn. I'm thinking about it seriously. But it's something that Rachel said that stuck with me that I want to know from you. The people around the world, when you meet them and they meet you, that connection that you make, even across cultures, across languages or dialects, what does that mean to you?
Well, I love doing that. And it's impossible to avoid politics. it really is.
Well, shoot.
Yeah. Well, shoot. Yeah. And I talked to a few Australians who, you know, they still love Americans, but they said, well, we don't want to come over right now. We've seen that you don't treat tourists or travelers very well over there. So we just as soon pass on that, which I feel kind of sad about that,
yeah.
But you know, it shouldn't keep any of us from going abroad. People are still people.
No matter where you go.
Wherever you go, yeah.
And Glenn's been everywhere.
Yeah, no, I haven't.
Well, where do you still want to go?
There's 200 countries in the world.
What are you missing?
I haven't. I did go through them, and I've been to about 60 of them so far. So, nice. You know, I'm barely a third of the way.
And only 140 to go, Glenn.
There's a chance I could run out of time.
He is the author of Travel Lessons, Your Personal Guide to Better Travel on Amazon. His upcoming book, Travel Lessons for Seniors, just back from Australia on Saturday. Glenn Schmidt, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Delightful. Thank you.
When we continue, the new season of Wisconsin Life on PBS Wisconsin is now underway with a new episode premiering tonight, and we have your preview next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to A Didgeridoo. Now in its 12th season, a new season of Wisconsin Life is underway on PBS Wisconsin with a premiere episode tonight at 7. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and joining us next, somebody you know, Angela Fitzgerald, host of Wisconsin Life, as well as Why Race Matters, which airs on PBS Wisconsin. Also here, Joel Waldinger, a series producer for PBS Wisconsin and a reporter for the Wisconsin Life Project. Angela and Joel, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This is a hard interview for me to do because I am a fan.
Oh, I appreciate that.
I have just enjoyed the way that Wisconsin Life has made me feel for years now. I want to thank you both for that feeling. And I want to start by asking you about how you make that feeling happen to the people that you watch. What is it that speaks to my Wisconsin soul from Wisconsin Life, Angela?
Well, I think the authenticity in the storytelling within both the on-location shoots that I'm a part of and the voiceover shoots that are produced by Joel and the production team, we really are intentional about sourcing stories that reflect the wide breadth of diversity within the state and that really speak to the Wisconsin experience and from angles that people might not necessarily suspect.
Right. Like, I can relate to it, but it's something I totally never would have seen or known or related to without you. Joel, where do you find these stories, these people?
I love that question because I get it all the time.
Yeah.
And they come from all over. But I have a couple of great stories. One, a few years ago, I was having a garage sale at my cabin near Rhinelander. And this Cadillac Escalade pulls in and these four or five guys get out, a couple of them with British accents, and I get to talking to them. And they were looking at stuff that my dad had collected while he was in the military in Japan, smoking jackets, some albums, things like that. And I got to talking to them, found out they were the group Badfinger.
What?
And you might not recognize their name, but you definitely recognize
their
music.
Song, yeah.
They were the first group that the Beatles signed to Apple Records. And there was a guy from Madison who, one of the band members had passed away. He replaced him, and he had been touring with Badfinger. They were headed to Michigan to play at a casino. I told them what I did. I said, hey, I'd really like to tell your story on Wisconsin Live. And they gave us full access.
Amazing. From a garage sale.
From a garage
sale. You
get
your ideas from a garage sale.
Basically, yeah. But also, one story can lead to another. Like, once you do a story with someone and they know the types of stories about people and passion and things like that, they're like, I know someone else that you might be interested in. So that's another way, but also just being curious.
But it also goes back to the way we're all connected. As these stories lead you from one to another, you find that in some way or other, we all go back to each other.
Absolutely.
Maybe that's the feeling, Angela. Where did this season take you? Where? Give us some of the far corners of the state that you've been to for Wisconsin Life.
Well, we traveled all over for this season that you all are currently viewing and that we filmed up until this past summer.
Oh, wow.
So it was very recent that, you know, everything was put together for your viewing enjoyment. But we went as far as Superior to spend time with the Superior City Football Club. We were able to attend the Juneteenth Festival in Milwaukee this past June. We went to Helenville to check out a local farm and try their fresh produce. And also, they had some animals there that was very fun to interact with. And then also, we went to Sheboygan for the Bookworm Gardens. Which
is tonight.
Yes, that one is tonight. And that was such a fun shoot. Just the creativity of that space. Yes, had a blast.
I am looking forward to seeing that. I've seen a preview. But also tonight, there is something about porcupine needles. Is that right?
I believe so, but I'm going to punt to Joel for that one.
Is there porcupine needles tonight?
There could be, but that's not my story. My story is about loons tonight.
You've got the loon researcher, and we have a little bit of a preview for you. Again, that's tonight at 7 on PBS Wisconsin, and here's a little bit of what you can expect.
For more than 30 years, Walter has been watching loons during his annual pilgrimage to northern Wisconsin.
I really love the solitude of being out on a lake in a canoe, watching loons, being sort of at one with them, watching them raise their families.
Walter is a loon behavior and reproduction specialist. His observations are providing new insights.
When you see loons preening, after they've done all that combing of the feathers, they'll get up and straighten out their wings by doing a wing flap.
However, the calls that echo across the lakes in the North Woods are still very much a mystery.
We've only begun to scratch the surface about what they're communicating with their calls.
Joel, where did you find Walter Piper?
So I wanted to do a story about loons.
Yeah.
That was my impetus.
You wanted the sound of the loons on the show.
Exactly. Uh-huh. What's more Wisconsin than loons?
I'm with you.
And I found out that Walter has been doing research in Vilas and Oneida County for the last like 35 years. He's actually a biology professor at Chapman University in California. And he comes to Wisconsin every year. He's the expert in our state right now on loons. And what I didn't know until the day before we shot the story is that they actually do all their research overnight.
What?
So we went out with him to capture these loons at night. We got great video by chance. It was luck, actually, that we got. We're able to capture this in the middle of the night, basically, and see the loons being captured. But what Walter's research shows is that the loon population in Wisconsin is being decimated by climate change. And so the loon population is dwindling. And he can see this over the past 35 years in his research. And he just wrote a new study on the water clarity and black flies and climate change and how there may come a day in the near future where we don't have loons on Wisconsin lakes anymore because they're just not hatching the same number of loons that they did 30 years ago.
I want to reject that. I want to say, like, there's a part of me that says, no, we're going to have loons, but that's a much bigger story to tell.
Yeah, and how iconic, the loons in Wisconsin.
Oh, wow. Angela, last week I saw you at Taliesin.
Yes.
With Minerva Montooth, which I thought was just the most amazing story. Here is a woman who lives at Taliesin. I didn't know anybody lived there.
Neither did I until the story.
You and me both then.
Yes. What's it like to walk into one of these shoots and meet these people and then try to share their story in a way that respects everything in a matter of a few minutes?
That's a great question, because when you're walking to a new setting, like, there's so much to take in.
Yeah.
And that's not even including the technical side of the setup and the things that we have to do.
The fourth wall.
Yes, the breaking that fourth wall,
uh-huh.
Yes. But focusing on the setting itself and the people, I really just try to find, like, a point of connection, because not everyone is comfortable with being on camera. I quickly learned that, because it feels easy to talk to people, but to talk to someone with cameras in their face and sometimes bright lights, depending on
the
situation, it's not. And so trying to establish a lane of comfortability for folks that they show up as their best selves, really try hard to do that along with the rest of the crew.
That's amazing. I mean, you think of the right questions to ask, but not necessarily the right tone or how to build a relationship within a matter of minutes with huge lights making you sweat.
Right. Right? Exactly.
You look at it from your perspective, Angela, it's a different shot.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I have a great time with it. But again, it's considering all those different elements and still trying to retain the personal connection. So that shows up within the story.
So coming up Monday on the Larry Mueller Show, we have the Taliesin story. And the Taliesin story has some really weird turns. Like, Frank Lloyd's right, his life turned at Taliesin. I'm fascinated with this place now because of the history of it, but also because it's still writing the history with Minerva Montooth still living there. I had no idea. Some of the other stories that we can expect this season, Angela, where else did you go that you'll be taking us to in the weeks to come?
Where else did we go? We checked out a zoo in Racine. That was fun. We're able to get up close and personal with animals in a way that I did not expect, like walking through a kangaroo space and thinking, is this safe? But that was set up.
You know, we were just in Australia, right? And we were just talking about how mean the kangaroos are there. Were they mean to you, Angela?
They were not. They were actually very calm, which was pleasant, because you're right. You're seeing all these images sometimes of strong-looking
kangaroos.
Right. That was not our experience at all.
Good.
They were very chill.
Looking forward to that. I didn't know there were kangaroos in Wisconsin.
There are. And then we spent some time in Walworth at the Bridge Food and Diaper Bank, which was a very heartwarming shoot, because I was able to interact and interview with a woman who... her family experienced some hardship. She was coming to the food pantry for the first time, and she just, like, literally broke down crying while we were talking just about the experience and the significance of that space and how it's supporting her family through this time of hardship.
Mm.
And then, I guess, lastly, I'll end with the Bergstrauf Mahler Museum of Glass.
Yes.
That was a fun, unexpectedly fun shoot, because we literally got to interact like children do. With creating art. So they had me in an art maker space creating, I think they were basically like ornaments out of broken glass.
Oh.
And they shipped it to my house. So it arrived like a couple of weeks ago. I was like, what's this box? Like,
this is the thing
that I made that had to go in the kiln. So I couldn't take it home after the shoot. And they were committed to shipping it to us. So it was just fun to just be in that setting and feel like a kid again.
Your fun is what translates through. Like, you having fun makes me have fun. And Joel, what's it like for you? I mean, putting this all together, I imagine, is work at some point. So how come it ends up feeling like so much fun?
I think part of it is the people and their passion. I meet so many interesting people in this job, traveling all over the state, as all of our crews do. And I think that is part of it. They entrust us with telling their story, and it becomes very personal. It becomes very personal for me to make sure that I get that story right. I get that tone right.
Yes.
And I want them to be proud of what story we are telling.
So after that story is told, what do they say to you? What kind of feedback do you get from the folks that you've featured in Wisconsin Life on PBS Wisconsin?
A lot of times it's like, I had no idea that this was going to turn out as good as it did. You encapsulated exactly what I wanted people to know. Or, you know, this past season for me as an interviewer, I've been doing this for a couple of decades now, and just the raw emotion that I was getting from people. My job as a producer, a reporter, is not to make the person that I'm interviewing cry. I look at it as to make the person at home feel that emotion.
Yeah.
And it definitely came through in several of the stories this year that we were working on. So, you know, the feedback is very positive, and that for me is the most rewarding thing, because they entrusted me with telling their story.
Joel Walding, our guest. He's a local series producer for PBS Wisconsin and a reporter for the Wisconsin Life Project. Also joining us, the host of Wisconsin Life, Angela Fitzgerald, also the host of Why Race Matters, which airs both on PBS Wisconsin. And if you have your favorite Wisconsin Life story, please join us. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@WPR.org. There's a new episode of Wisconsin Life airing tonight at 7 on PBS Wisconsin, and there will be porcupine quills. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you are listening to WPR News. Ever been to Bookworm Gardens in Sheboygan? Well, you can go tonight with PBS Wisconsin's Wisconsin Life. A new season is now underway, and you can find it all brand new Thursday nights at 7 on PBS Wisconsin. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and our guests are Angela Fitzgerald, host of Wisconsin Life, and Joel Waldinger. He's a producer with the Wisconsin Life Project, and you can join us as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And I have another clip for an upcoming show. I'm not sure when this will be, but it has an accordion in it. The World of Accordions Museum, Joel.
Yeah, that was up in Superior. And this is a story, again, where I had heard about the museum, but I didn't know a lot of the backstory of the person who put it together. And her story is fascinating. It starts in World War II.
Let's hear a little bit and get a preview.
Accordion music has danced across our state for nearly 200 years. Brought from the old world by European immigrants, that polka sound is synonymous with Wisconsin.
It's unique and beautiful. Everybody loves it.
That's especially true for Helmy Strahl Harrington.
I've never known another Helmy. It means pearl in Finnish.
Helmy is a pearl like none other, and she founded the world's largest accordion museum.
It's nice that it happens to be Wisconsin. And I say with absolutely no modesty that we are the best, because we have the most, but we also have the most unusual. And some of these are really quite remarkable.
Wisconsin, not known for its modesty, evidently. We are the best. 2,500 accordions up in Superior, and who knew without Wisconsin Life, Joel?
Yeah, absolutely. But what makes this really interesting is her mom made a living playing the accordion after World War II at a Red Cross camp. And before they immigrated to the United States, she wanted to bring three accordions with her. And there was a U.S. soldier on the ship who said, no one needs three accordions, so he threw one overboard. Now, this is her living. So she comes to this country with two accordions, teaches her daughter everything she knows, and her daughter now has over 2,500 accordions.
That is an amazing story.
Yeah.
I don't know where it would get told if there wasn't this forum for Wisconsin Life. Angela, what's the team like? Because I know you're front and center in all of this, and it's your voice and it's your face, but what's it like to work with this Wisconsin Life team?
It's been great. I've had the privilege, I will say, of working with the Wisconsin Life team for, I think it's been 8 years now that I've been with the show. So, excuse me, Kelly, our producer, is amazing. We have awesome videographers, awesome producers, and there have been people that were around originally that aren't here anymore who've gone on to awesome things and some who remain, but it's a great team, a very humble team that does great work and are very nimble and how they can adjust to maybe some environmental conditions that weren't expected, because that's one of the unique elements of shooting outside of a studio space where things are controlled. You just have to kind of go with the flow to make it work. And so I admire the technical expertise that is brought into a shoot setting that allows us to produce what you all get to see.
And the thing about technical expertise is you only notice it when it goes wrong. Like technical expertise, when it happens right, you don't even know it's there. And that's kind of the feeling with Wisconsin life is I feel like I'm there with Angela and her guest and walking through Taliesin with Minerva. It's just an amazing experience. But it's all because that fourth wall and behind the scenes, there's a lot technically going on that you don't even think of when it goes right. That's really impressive. And I think when you're, because our Wisconsin life here on WPR News features Maureen McCollum, and I see a lot of similarities with you and Maureen, Angela. Like, you are looking to make that connection with people at where they are, and then share that with us in a way that I think is an art form as much as it is a science, to bring other people into your interpersonal conversations that you're having, and that ain't easy.
Absolutely. It's not. And that's why I greatly appreciate people giving up their time and their stories for us to share and entrusting us to share their stories in the right way.
But how do you become Angela Fitzgerald or Maureen McCollum? Like,
I don't even know if I have an answer to that. 'Cause I don't know if I've become what you're describing exactly yet. But I will say it's definitely been a journey. Having the opportunity to host Wisconsin Life. I am a naturally pretty introverted person, so there's a part of me that I have to turn on to do this work, and when I'm on, and then afterwards I'm like, okay,
I gotta go.
Now it's time
recuperate,
to, yes.
Recharge.
Now it's time to go get back on the charger. But it's fun. Like I said, the crew is amazing, and we get to connect with so many great people that it often just feels fun. It doesn't feel like work in the traditional sense. So I do appreciate that.
And I can relate. Joel, what is it about an introvert that brings other people out? That it just sort of, like, it brings the story that they want to tell and creates this feature that becomes something that they're so proud of, like you talk about.
I think a lot of it is trust. Mm-hmm. We have to earn their trust. And we've done this now for 12
right?
seasons. We can show them samples of work that we've done. And it might be something similar, not exactly, but something they might be interested in, whether it be wood carving or fishing or something along those lines. And they see the work and the professionalism that we put in. And, you know, a lot of it is, like Angela said, you've got to quickly develop a relationship with that person.
Which can feel artificial if you don't do it right.
But if you do your research in advance and you
right.
know going in things about this person, things they're interested in. And I think the other thing is, I am truly interested in what they have to say.
There it is. This ability to be open, curious, empathetic all at once. Those are things that aren't always easy to be as a person, just out and about. So to be able to have that skill, I think, speaks volumes. In your time at Wisconsin Life, Angela, what's one memory that sticks out to you as, like, geez, I can't believe this happened, whether it was on camera or off? Is there a moment?
I will say one of my, I think it was the very first season that I joined Wisconsin Life, and we went, I don't remember the location city-wise, but Jurassic Park will stand out in my mind for, I don't know, maybe the rest of eternity for me.
What is Jurassic Park?
Jurassic Park is a interesting hobby that evolved for a retired man who was into welding. So he created all these metal sculptures in his yard, in his home, for people to just tour and enjoy and interact with. And you could tell he was having a blast just walking people around and showing them these random creations, some that were huge, on his lawn for people to view. And so that, to me, was an early indication of, okay, this is what Wisconsin Life is about.
Uh-huh.
Like, showing off interesting things, people just leaning into what brings them joy,
mm-hmm.
and providing a platform for the rest of the state to enjoy them as well.
Jurassic Park is in Marshfield.
Thank you.
I did not know this. Somebody else knew this on the other side. Joel, how long have you been in Wisconsin Life? Have you been there since the beginning?
I've been there since the beginning, yeah. I've been with PBS Wisconsin for about 17 years.
So how did Wisconsin Life get off the ground then? What's the origin story?
Well, we were looking for, part of it was a partnership with radio.
Oh.
And your Wisconsin Life that you guys do there. And originally the show was non-hosted, and then we luckily found Angela to come along for the ride, so to speak, and to bring viewers along as well. So it has evolved over the years, but the core mission is always people and their passion and storytelling.
What's the story that sticks out to you after 12 years?
There's one that I did they're all like my babies. So you're asking me my favorite child.
Who's your favorite child? Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really hard because I have a lot of favorites. I have a lot of children out there, so to speak, in the video world. But I did one on a guy who was a log roller, professional log roller, up in Hayward. And he describes how, as a kid, you don't go to the swimming pool, you go to the log rolling pond, and you learn to log roll. And he was a 5-time world champion. He was ESPN's Lumberjack Man of the Year. And then 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. And he decided to join the military and went to Iraq. And unfortunately, an IED blew off parts of both of his arms. And all he wanted to do was, he was recovering, was log roll. And when he came back, he didn't have that balance.
Right.
He wanted to give it up, and he kept at it. And he won 4 more world championships.
What?
With basically, you know, an arm and a half after his disability in the military. So that was a story that was an interview that I didn't want to end. Like, yeah. I could have just kept going because he was so fascinating. And he treated it all with humor, which I found really interesting.
Not it's, poor me, but.
No, not at all. Not
let's
at
laugh
all.
At this and move on.
Yeah.
What are, so everybody's got a story to share. I mean, everybody's got something special that makes them who they are. And Wisconsin Life is in the business of featuring stories like these. How do folks reach out to you and say, I think I know somebody or something that would be perfect for Wisconsin Life?
We get emails all the time from people, or out on a story, they'll see I'm doing one right now on the Ice Age Trail, and the guy that is basically puts the scenic in the scenic trail, he does all of the wild.
I didn't know there was a guy for that.
The wild seeds and the maintenance of the trail and all of that. And while I was doing that story, a lady came up to me and said, hey, look, I have muscular dystrophy, and I want to walk the entire length of the Ice Age Trail. So, again, we get our stories from all different places.
Hmm. Angela Fitzgerald, what are your hopes for the future of this program? Where do you want it to go?
I've recently become fascinated at archives, like archiving history. And I think when we think of the concept of an archival project, we think of like significant firsts or things that stand out in all of our minds. But I also view Wisconsin Life as a historical archive of sorts.
Absolutely.
And it just excites me to think about the history that's being documented through Wisconsin Life. And so just kind of seeing that continue in the ways that we've been able to do it and maybe elevating and expanding what that looks like for the future. But even just that recognition that this is history that we're gathering here, and hope people 10, 20, 30 plus years from now can come back and glean something from watching old episodes.
There are still places for you to see in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. We have not been everywhere. And I'm open to checking out those unseen places.
That's very cool. Joel, what can we expect in the weeks to come in this season of Wisconsin Life? What are you looking forward to?
Yeah, so I have a couple of stories. One about a young woman from Ashland who actually became the youngest person to circumnavigate the globe on a motorcycle.
I do believe. Is that tonight?
That is tonight as well.
Yes, Bridget McCutcheon from Nashville.
Interesting backstory. You talk about how we get stories. I went to high school with her dad. Neither of us lived in Wisconsin at the time, and I saw him post something on Facebook that his daughter was going to do this, and I messaged him. I said, hey, Jeff, you know what I do? Can we get access to Bridget? And she took a GoPro along, and you will see the most amazing shots of her journey through 45 countries, 50,000 miles, her ups and her downs, and there were many downs, and she did not quit.
That's tonight at 7 on PBS Wisconsin. You can find it online at wisconsinlife.org, which I imagine you can find the email address so you can share your story with Angela and Joel. And I want to thank you both for what you do. I want to thank you for the way it makes me feel, and I want to thank you for sharing it with us today on The Larry Mueller Show. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Angela Fitzgerald is the host of Wisconsin Life tonight at 7 on PBS Wisconsin. Joel Waldinger is a series producer for PBS Wisconsin. He's been there since the beginning, a reporter for the Wisconsin Life Project. I want to thank them both for being with us, as well as you for being a part of our show and the team that makes it all possible. Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaud, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and of course, Larry Mueller. It's Garden Talk tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show, starting at 11. Aaron Presley will join us from the Old Brick Gardens. And also, Adam Alexander, the seed detective, tells us all about the accidental seed heroes. That's tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show, starting at 11. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Today, and you're listening to WPR News.